Okay, are you keeping score? Because a lot's been happening real quickly back at, I should say, not Washington, D.C., but in Mar-a-Lago, where all these appointments are being announced. Welcome, everybody, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. So great talking to you this Friday, 15th day of November. The month of November is halfway gone. What? Man, that was quick. Anyway, we have a list of all of Donald Trump's top appointments, and we'll be talking about each and every one of them and whether it's a hit or a miss or something in between. Right now, generally speaking, I just think he's off to an incredibly fast start. And I love most of these appointments. I like some of them. There's only one to me that's a real clunker. I think it's the same one that most people think is a clunker, but we'll get to that. We'll get to all that later. Here's the good news, though. The good news is that we're not going to have some of the woke idiocy that we have almost gotten accustomed to. Maybe, you know, the good news is that while a lot of people had gotten used to this woke nonsense back in Washington, the average voter did not and is pushed back on November 5th. I think that was an undercurrent in the election. And let me just give you an example of the kind of thing we're not going to have to put up with much longer. With Donald Trump securing a Senate majority for the Republicans. And again, I think Donald Trump is responsible for getting these senators over the finish line. He's got 53. The Democrats are essentially looking at a future where they're politically neutered. So they are trying to rush through and get some of these radical judicial nominees confirmed so they can get a lifetime appointment on the federal bench. One of them is from the state of Oregon. He's a magistrate. He wants to be a federal judge. The Democrats are trying to push him through. His name is Mustafa Kasabai. He appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which means you have to survive an appearance before Louisiana Senator John Kennedy, who asked why this judge has such a preoccupation with people's pronouns. Have a listen.
I'm looking at an order you issued as a magistrate judge here requiring the use of pronouns in your court. Do you require the use of pronouns, the declaration of one's pronouns in your court?
Senator, that may be referring to perhaps a trial management order or a scheduling order of some kind?
Yeah. No, it's a statement. You issued it. Here it is.
It's an invitation for people to identify their pronouns and or their honorifics.
Well, I'm looking at your requirement that you issued to all people in your court. You say, quote, when you introduce yourself in a meeting, you should say, my name is Judge Blank, and my pronouns are blank. Is that right?
Senator, those were not requirements or rules. Those were suggestions. Those were suggestions and invitations for people to use.
And you also, in your directive, you say, quote, I'd like counsel to introduce themselves, giving your full name and your honorific, such as Ms., Ms. Period, Mix, or Mr., not Mrs., and if your client will be making an appearance, I ask you to please introduce them to the court by giving me their full name and their honorific, such as Ms. and Ms. Period, Mix, or Mr.
Someone who wants to be a federal judge really needs to know if you prefer to be called Mix, M-X. And you'll note that the examples that this magistrate used did not include Mrs. Mr., Ms., or Mix. This is Mustafa Kasabai, who wants to be a federal judge. They've been trying to push him on the bench for a year, and the Republicans have blocked him. And now they're trying to put him through again. October of 2023. Again, he's been trying to get on the bench since last year. Utah Senator Mike Lee, at his confirmation hearings, said to the magistrate, Judge Kasabai, you included the following in your remarks. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, is the heart and soul of the court system. Can we say that? Yeah, I just did, and I say it proudly. Close quote. Judge Lee said, Could you please explain what that means? And of course, well, access to justice is at the heart of the work I do within the courtroom, ensuring everyone is dignified, treated with dignity when they come into the courtroom, and for me to preside over those cases, close quote. That is not what DEI is all about. It's not about dignity. It's about division. It's about defining someone by their race. It's about defining someone by their gender or by their sexual orientation. Judge Kasabai would be, according to the Daily Wire, I don't know if this is correct, say that he would be the first Muslim American appointed to the federal bench. I don't know. He is a Muslim American. I don't know if he would be the first. Anyway, when the whole business with referring to people as MX, mix, that had Senator Tom Cotton just laughing. When your work provokes laughter on the Senate Judiciary Committee, maybe you're applying for the wrong job. Maybe you have no business being on the federal bench. It is 12 minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning on The Commute with Carlson. First hour of the show, we are going to be talking about all of Donald Trump's nominations so far. And then at 6:30, we're going to replay a phone conversation I had with a listener about why things went so well at the federal level, but so poorly at the state level. And we got some very interesting text messages from listeners. And you are welcome to join that conversation at 6:35. Just go ahead and text us your sentiments about why we did so lousy at the state level and what we need to do to get back on our feet and start winning the kind of victories at the state level that we are winning nationally. That number is 206-421-5757. That's 206-421-5757. Okay, so here is who is on Donald Trump's list so far to carry out his agenda and what I think of them. And you are certainly welcome to call or text your feelings about these names as well. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Florida Senator, tough on China, which is good. Tough on Iran, which is even better. You want peace in the Middle East? Crack down on Iran and remove their ability, eliminate their ability to produce a nuclear weapon. So I think Marco Rubio is a 10 strike. I think that he's going to be outstanding. Next choice, the one choice here that I just think is a clunker, is Matt Gaetz, Attorney General. The good part about Matt Gaetz, his stands on most issues are pretty good, and he will be very loyal to President Trump. But he's not someone who would be an effective attorney general. It would be if Kamala Harris had won, making AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, attorney general. The other thing about Matt Gaetz is that he very nearly blew up the House Republican majority. He was actually working with AOC and Nancy Pelosi to sabotage the speakership of Kevin McCarthy. And he succeeded in getting rid of McCarthy. McCarthy stepped back because he didn't want to imperil the majority, which would have happened. So very few people in the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives has many good things to say about Matt Gaetz. He's bombastic. He's a bomb thrower. And that would make him singularly ineffective as an AG. I'll tell you who would be a good AG is Donald Trump has chosen a deputy AG, and his name is Todd Blanche. Todd Blanche would be a superb attorney general. He is Donald Trump's lawyer. He is extremely effective and respected, and he would do a superb job running the Department of Justice. So I hope that if Matt Gaetz is not confirmed, I hope that it goes to Todd Blanche. So we'll see what happens. But here's my prediction. Matt Gaetz will not be confirmed by the Republican Senate to be AG. Just too much baggage. And we haven't even gotten to his ethic problems. Let's put it this way. There is an ethics report ready to come out, and Matt Gaetz resigned so that it wouldn't come out. He resigned 2 days before the report was to go public. Obviously, if he makes it to the Senate confirmation hearings, that report is going to get leaked. It's going to go public. And he clearly is in no hurry to see it come before the public. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, I think, is a wonderful appointment. An Army officer, did tours in Afghanistan and Iraq earned a pair of bronze stars. He's being called a Fox News personality, but again, he's about a whole lot more than that. Also wrote a wonderful book, The War on Our Warriors, about how woke ideology in the Pentagon is threatening morale and effectiveness of our troops and is hurting recruitment, which it clearly is. No branch is meeting its recruitment goals, even though they have lowered the standards and they've lowered their estimates for their targets. They still are falling short. Pete Hegseth will attack that whole infrastructure of DEI and critical race theory and all this nonsense that has coursed its way through the culture of the Pentagon. And if you want to make America safer again, make sure we get the best people to join the military. And there are a lot more appointments, which we will get to throughout the course of today's program. As the Commute with Carlson continues, Philip J. Vandervoort III, with the first social media sweep of the morning. Boy, time for me to get another cup of coffee, young Zach. All right. It is 20 minutes after 6 o'clock. The social media sweep around the corner. Good morning. All right. Bringing back some memories. I remember when this movie was playing. Hard Day's Night with the Beatles. All right. Philip J. Vandervoort III. What's going on in the social media world?
Let's pick up on a couple of things related to the election. And my first one, it kind of dovetails with what you brought up here in the last segment about the different nominees for the Trump administration. And my question is, for all the political partisans out there, why is Tim Walz's 24 years in the Army National Guard a credible part of his candidacy as vice president, but Pete Hegseth's 20-year service in the Army National Guard, let alone his actual deployments in Iraq, somehow are not credible for his nomination as defense secretary? Why is that?
Well, there you go. I mean, that shows the double standard.
I mean, Tim Walz is going to be heartbeat away from the president.
And let us remember,
with his National Guard service,
Tim Walz never saw a day in a combat zone, though he fibbed about it and said he did.
When push came to shove, he decided not to. Yeah.
And then when he was about to be deployed to a war zone, Iraq, he retired.
Yeah.
He left. So the one, you know, he's in the guard, and just when they're actually, okay, now we're going to be deploying, oh, I'm retiring. So Hegseth was in both Iraq and Afghanistan. I mentioned a pair of not just Bronze Stars, but Army Commendation medals. So I think he brings a soldier's perspective to the job, and that might be a refreshing change in the Pentagon.
Yeah. Okay, there's just some free thought there. It has nothing to do with the social media sweep. That was just something I was wondering about based on the last couple of days. So the social media sweep, let's get that in officially, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Actor Wendell Pierce, tremendous actor, famous for HBO's The Wire. He's really great in the Amazon reboot of Jack Ryan with John Krasinski. He gets to play Admiral Greer in the Tom Clancy storyline. Yeah. But Wendell Pierce is definitively anti-Trump, and he posted this about Pete Hegseth as the defense secretary nominee. Pete Hegseth is the epitome of white privilege. A weekend anchor on Fox, a major in the National Guard, will be the head of the most powerful military in the history of the world. Military is supposed to be apolitical. Pete Hegseth is purely political.
No.
Okay.
I first of all don't agree with that.
Yeah.
Secondly, Pete Hegseth was not hired according to race. You can make a very good case that Lloyd Austin, the current Department of Defense secretary, was hired according to race.
That was one of the criticisms. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think that this actor wants to go there.
Yeah. And calling a cabinet, this is one of the things that jumped out to me, calling any cabinet appointment purely political, that's what every political cabinet appointee is. It's always about politics. And then somebody else in the thread posted, it would be laughable to accuse Pete Hegseth of white privilege when he's earned every step of his career. You know, he's put in the time. He's been promoted. It's pretty much pro forma based on so much of this service. And to just default to calling it white privilege, I think, shows that real lack of understanding. Yeah,
it shows they don't have an argument.
Yeah. So
they don't have an argument, so they get into name calling.
Yeah. So, and I'm trying to see if I can pull up one more here. Oh, yeah. This is really surreal when a former MTV VJ is starting to make a lot of sense. And I'll freely admit, I did not have this anywhere near my 2024 bingo card. But Pauly Shore, the 1990s, yeah, 1990s goofball MTVJ,
exactly,
attempted a couple of really
like Bobcat Goldthwait, you know, someone who was just like there for 15 minutes, became briefly famous.
Rob Dyrdek, maybe, but
yeah, right, Rob.
I did not expect Pauly Shore.
What Ridiculousness, is that the Rob Dyrdek one? I'm trying to remember exactly what his show was called on MTV. But Pauly Shore posted this about politics and late night TV shows. He writes, "Is there a reason why all late night shows just talk about politics? When I was growing up and I was going on the David Letterman show or Arsenio Hall show, there would be a couple of jokes about politics, and then the rest was just," as he writes, "random bleep." And he writes, "Can we just get back to the random stuff, boys? Any subject too much to be agreed upon?" So, I mean, even Pauly Shore is kind of like, wow, the politics is just so intense with these late night hosts like Colbert, Kimmel now.
Well,
so
let me give a reason why.
Yeah.
That, you know, Seth Meyers.
And Seth Meyers is perfect in that.
Stephen Colbert and especially Jimmy Kimmel. Here's why they're political. Because they're not funny.
Yeah, as they get more political, they certainly get less funny.
Well, they're not comedians. They are not good comedians. They just know how to make people who agree with them politically laugh. And he does that by indulging resentment and animosity, mockery, ridicule, and even hatred of political opponents, i.e. Republicans. So that's the problem. These guys are not fit to shine Johnny Carson's shoes. Okay, there are some, or frankly, Letterman. Letterman would occasionally get political, but Letterman was a comic genius. Kimmel, Colbert, Seth Meyers, no, they're just not there. It's 6:31, The Commute with Carlson. When we come back, why did things go so well for Republicans, conservatives nationally, and so awful locally? We'll get right into it and get your reaction, your phone calls, your text messages at 206-421-5757. 23 minutes to 7 o'clock on the John Carlson Show. Yesterday, late in the show, I took a phone call from KVI listener Chris in Tacoma. And he was saying what a lot of you have been thinking, which is, how on earth did we do so well nationally and then lose almost everything here in Washington State? How did that happen? And we talked about it. Chris, Tacoma, you're up on the John Carlson Show. Good morning.
Good morning, John. Thanks. Hey, I'm elated over the federal results, but for the state, I'm glad I have a therapist on retainer. hey, the R's are really feckless, and one metric I might use for that was seeing the opening statement by Stokesbury at the last session, and I think that encapsulates the entire Republican Party here in the state. Can we just get along? Can I just kind of be kind of like Lori Jenkins, but maybe just not quite as bad?
Well, what did he say?
Can't win that way. Well, I don't know that I could give you a verbatim or paraphrase, but the general tone was, we just want to work with you, and you know, you'll be our guide, and we're there to help. And I would just submit.
No, they're not there they're there to fight. They're there to fight for their constituents. They're there to fight for their values. And I know Drew Stokesbury. He knows this. But look. Here is a reality that surprises a lot of people.
Yeah.
The Democratic candidates who ran for statewide office, they all won. But you know what else, Chris?
Yeah.
They ran way behind Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris defeated Donald Trump in Washington State by about 18 to 19 percentage points. Bob Ferguson defeated Dave Reichert by about 10 percentage points, maybe even less than that now. So here is this commanding advantage over Trump, but it didn't materialize into a similar victory in any of the statewide races. Most of the Democrats won by about 10 to 12, maybe 14 percentage points.
Right.
But in the presidential race, the Democrats, you know, had a 19 percentage point lead. The Republicans all ran ahead of President Trump's total. So that's kind of interesting.
Sure. It is interesting, and it's worth a forensic analysis, but I know that we lost every state race.
Yes.
And I also know that when I observe Dave Reichert, God bless him, and some of the other ones, it seems like a very feckless campaign and response. But you know, for instance, you know, Mr. Cairo is asking Dave Reichert about, you know, the support of Trump. They try to hammer him on that. And I just want somebody to say, of course I'm going to support the GOP nominee. Why wouldn't I? And are you going to ask Ferguson if he's going to support the Democrat nominee? That's your line of curiosity. And by the way, what's your objection to Trump? Lay it on me, Mr. Cairo. What's your objection to his policy? And how has that negatively affected you or your family? Go, explain it to me. And
yeah.
I just don't hear that. I'm not saying that verbatim, but that kind of fire in the belly. Trump has shown us this. He wins.
Right. Trump has passion.
Yes.
And people respond to passion because that's what motivates them. They're inspired by a candidate who brings not only intelligence but passion to the job. He really wants the job. She really wants the job because they really want to improve your life. And I'm going to fight for it. And here's what I'm going to do. You should never run on issues. You should run on ideas. Ideas, because issues by themselves are just that, issues. But ideas suggest you're moving in one direction or another to resolve the issue, to handle the problems. I just found it, you know, interesting. Several of our statewide candidates lost by about 5 or 6 points. Dave Reichert lost by 10. But the Kamala Harris campaign defeated Trump by 19 points. So
it's interesting. Yeah. And I think they all should be worth examination. I mean, Olson did well, relatively. I agree with all that. It's all good to look at. It's just the Mr. Rogers happy talk is driving the electorate. That would be me.
Yeah.
Crazy.
No, you, I think you are dead on. Did you hear happy talk from Bob Ferguson? Ferguson's campaign was relentless and very simple. The message was, I'm running against someone who's going to take away abortion rights and loves Donald Trump. And
right.
he kept banging on those two issues. That's all when he talked about Dave Reichert, that's all his campaign talked about, just those two things. They kept it simple, and they kept repeating it over and over again. That's the kind of message discipline that the Republicans needed to show this time. The Dave Reichert campaign should have hit Bob Ferguson over and over again with fentanyl. This is the guy who wanted to legalize fentanyl. This is the guy who wanted to legalize the drug that killed over 3,000 people in the state of Washington.
Yeah,
and just say it over and over and over again. But again, this is one thing that, going back a long time now, Democrats are just better on messaging than Republicans. They find a message and they stick with it, even when it's a lie. They stick
yes, they
with
do.
It. Okay, so what do you think? Let me know, 206-421-5757. Either call or text 206-421-5757. Let's go to John. He's calling from Tacoma. Go for it, John.
Yeah, I think kind of what you guys are hitting on is exactly it. Republicans are a little bit weak in this state, and one of the reasons is that they do not want to cause an uproar. They don't want to get challenged, have the Democrats come after them by getting challenged and have somebody placed in their positions. So they kind of back off and just say, no, we're just going to defend our own area. Well, at the same time, the Democrats are going to go after those Republican areas, and they're just feckless and weak, and there's no networking, no strong networking throughout the state. And it's hard to do that when speech is regulated. You guys were talking about this. The left can say whatever they want. Any kind of verbiage they want to use, they can do that to demonize Republicans. Republicans say that? Absolutely not. Oh, that's hate speech. You're a racist. You're, you know, all of that. And that is what the whole Democrat Party in the United States has been pushing. You've been able to fight back in certain areas.
All right.
But Washington State, one of the big things there, you have a lot of people that have left that were conservatives. You have a lot of people coming in that are liberals. That's changing the dynamics there.
Yeah.
And then
that's a good point, John. the dynamic, the demographics have changed. Washington is now, for the first time in history, state history, more people leaving than moving to Washington. Not by a lot, but by enough. It's noticeable. And the five states that people who are Republican, the five states that people are moving to from Washington, the top five are Idaho and Texas and Ohio and Kentucky, believe it or not, and I think Arizona. In other words, five red states. The states that people are moving from to move to Washington are California, Oregon, Hawaii, Illinois, if you can believe it, five, then Utah. So four of the five states that people are moving from are Democrat states, liberal states, blue states. And all five of the states that people are moving out of Washington to move to are red states. So that is part of it. But my view, very simply, is Republicans need to make it clear what they're fighting for. And they need to make it clear who's to blame for things being bad. Who's to blame for things being bad? People are furious about crime, furious about the problems associated with homelessness, furious with the drug situation. All of these things are a direct result of policies from one party. One party rule in Olympia, one party rule in King County, one party rule in Seattle. Is all Democrats. And the Republicans have not made that case. They assume people know this. They don't. People who don't follow politics don't know who to blame. And so, you know, after the Dobbs decision, Democrats knew exactly who to blame in a pro-choice state like Washington. It wasn't the Supreme Court. It was everything with an R by its name. The Republicans need to return the favor. Simple, clear messaging, who's to blame for what ticks you off. Oh, and by the way, our ideas will fix what they broke. That's another thing that Donald Trump talked about. They broke it, we'll fix it. It's 49 minutes after 6 o'clock. Checking in with our good buddy Lars Larson right around the corner of the Commute with Carlson. Boy, it's a black sky overhead, but what a gorgeous moon. Absolutely gorgeous way to open up Friday on the John Carlson Show. Lars Larson, our noon to three host. Good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, John, and I'm glad with the way, I'm happy with the way that things are going in America right now. I think we're on the right path.
Oh, yeah. I mean, right now, I am, every day, I just say we're taking a step in the right direction every day. So tell me real quickly,
yeah,
your favorite appointee of Donald Trump's new administration so far.
Pete Hegseth. Because having somebody who's actually got on-the-ground experience as a member of the military, being defense secretary, instead of somebody with just, you know, academic credentials or political credentials, I think that's powerful. I've got some questions about Marco Rubio. I've got some questions about Matt Gaetz for attorney general.
So let me ask you about Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, sure. Oh, I love that in a lot of ways. I hate his positions on about a dozen different issues, and I've got a list of things where he is a full-blown, hardcore, left-wing, tree-hugging, oil-hating greenie. But turn him loose on the FDA, the NIH, the CDC, and all those other alphabet agencies.
I'll tell you where opposition is starting to grow, because we're talking about Health and Human Services.
Yep.
His abortion.
I know. I don't
stance.
Like that. Except that if he'll take orders from the top, HHS may be a good place to start putting a clamp down on those sometimes deadly abortion pills that are now more than 50% of all abortions in America.
Lars Larson, every day of the work week from noon to three on the John Carlson Show. Hour number two of the commute straight ahead. You're right where you need to be. Talk Radio 570 KVI. 3 minutes. After 7 o'clock in the morning, the Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. How are you doing? Go ahead and let me know at 206-421-5757. Call or text. Boy, we have a lot of things we want to get into, and I want to start local with several stories. A bombshell announcement of criminal charges being brought against the patron saint of Seattle's homeless industrial complex, the Reverend David Bloom. He has been involved in what's called urban ministry for decades, well over 45 years. He helped found the Downtown Emergency Services Center, which the Seattle Times euphemistically calls the largest homeless service provider, or one of Seattle's largest homeless service provider. It is also the place with the most 911 calls in the entire city. Basically, if you look at how Seattle has handled homelessness, this is the guy who deserves a lot of the blame, and he's being charged with possessing child pornography. On March 7th, Microsoft notified the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children that somebody in Seattle had uplifted several illicit files to its database. Seattle police detectives located the person using his IP address in June, got a warrant to search his house in September. It was the activist, homeless activist, social justice advocate David Bloom. They spoke to him at his house on September 20th. He admitted to uploading the photos, which were graphic, showing children as young as 5 in sexual situations with adults. He told detectives he had been viewing child porn for about 3 to 4 years, and he thanked officers for coming to his home and holding an intervention for him. Back in the 1970s, he founded, along with a radical John Fox back in the day, the Seattle Displacement Coalition. And he has been involved ever since. It was on the board of Real Change, the nonprofit weekly newspaper. He ran once for office, did not come close. His attorney did not respond to a request for comment. He was ultimately charged with 1 count of second-degree dealing and 1 count of second-degree possession of explicit images of children. Prosecutors only wanted $5,000 bail. This is an eye-opener for sure. And you have to wonder just how many years has this guy really been? So now, of course, the homeless industrial complex is distancing itself from him. While we are talking about criminal conduct, outrageous criminal conduct of a different kind happening at the home of the University of Washington president. Now, the president of the University of Washington is given a small mansion, a home, a very nice home, just a few miles from the UW campus. But Anna Mari Cousy lives in her own house. And I think the home that she's been graced with as a perk for being president, they use for entertainment, receptions,
events, yeah,
things like that. Her private home was attacked. And so was her automobile with pro-Hamas and anti-Israel messages by vandals who actually boasted about what they did. They posted images of the attack on her home. As brazen as it gets, here's Como 4's coverage.
Video posted anonymously to Instagram shows the intrusive vandalism done to the private property of UW President Anna Mari Cousy. The group targets her front porch, dousing it in red paint. Then they turn to her car. They slash the tires and spray paint pro-Hamas and Palestinian messages.
Just because you're a protester doesn't mean you get to vandalize somebody's home, somebody's car, and we don't know who's in there. We don't know if she has kids. I don't know. It's just a terrifying thing.
You know, I know Anna Mari Cousy, and of course we differ on a lot of things, and I think she handled the issue of the tent encampment on campus by Hamas activists terribly. I think that it is a low water mark in her tenure. And the voice you just heard of a local leader in the Jewish community condemning the attack on her home, if you want to see just what they did to her place, we've got it posted at KVI.com. But here's more of what the attackers posted after the vandalism.
Threatening the president, the post writes, until UW ends their relationship with Boeing, we will continue to put pressure on all leaders in all aspects of their lives.
So I believe when you go to someone's home and do something like this, that is an act of terror, okay? It's an act of physical intimidation. They're telling you that you are not safe in your own home from them. So I don't even like when you go to someone's personal home to demonstrate, but when you go to someone's home and you vandalize, wearing, of course, the black bloc, dressed all in black with black masks on. You know what these guys are? They're basically, they're just the flip side of the same coin from the Ku Klux Klan. The Ku Klux Klan used to wear white bloc with white masks.
Right, covering their identity.
To conduct, you know, terror and intimidation against people. And now it's just the black bloc wearing black masks. And again, it's to physically intimidate Annamari Kauzi and to say, you know, to other people who are in a position of authority, hey, you could be next. We hit her. Hey, we hit that congressman out in Bellevue, Adam Smith. We went after his place.
What was that, like a year ago? Was that less than a year ago?
They went to his place over a year ago, and then on election eve, he was running against a Hamas-supporting activist. They rallied in front of his house. Again, rallying in a public place, fine. Rallying at his congressional office, if they wanted to have a sit-in or something like that, civil disobedience, okay, fine. But when you rally at someone's house, you are sending a message of intimidation. This is not free speech and free expression. This is over the line. Okay, it's not dissent. It's disruption and it's intimidation. Let's go to the rest of that Cuomo story.
Hours later, Cruz spent the day cleaning the messages off Kelsey's car and front porch, an image the regional director for the American Jewish Committee says is a message of how far these groups will go.
If you look at some of the things they put on the social media posts, they use the words, "We demand." And until those demands are met, they're not going to back down.
This most recent act of vandalism comes after large demonstration on UW's campus, including a quad takeover of pro-Palestinian activists who want the school to cut ties with Israel and divest from companies that do business with the country.
And a spokesperson for the university said that this act of vandalism, as well as some past crimes, will not influence the university's policy. We've not yet heard from the president of the university herself yet. Live in Seattle, Hannah Knowles, Cuomo News.
In response to the vandalism, the American Jewish Committee released a statement saying in part, quote, "This heinous act went beyond the damage we have come to expect from anti-Israel protesters on campus. The perpetrators must be held accountable, and a message must be sent that there will be zero tolerance for acts of hate and anti-Semitism at UW and in our community."
Why would there be zero tolerance for acts of hate and intimidation against Jewish students? And acts of vandalism would be not tolerated if there hasn't been any consequences for anti-Semitism and acts of hate and vandalism so far. You know, the UW allowed these people to have an overnight, they were allowed to stay overnight at the Husky Union building, the hub, and they trashed it. No consequences. No consequences. Thousands and thousands of dollars of damage. Oh, somebody else will pay that bill. Then they say they are going to set up an encampment on the quad. The quad is, think of every spring you hear about the cherry blossoms at the University of Washington, and the cherry blossoms are framed by these stately buildings, which are just the epitome of traditional college campus. And they said, we're gonna put an encampment on the quad if you give us permission. And they gave them permission. After they trashed the hub, they let them set up an encampment. And then, of course, people in the encampment started vandalizing all of these gorgeous, gothic academic buildings with graffiti. No one held accountable. Nobody fined. Nobody kicked out of school. Nobody suspended. No staff people who are part of all, none of them fired. So now when we hear hate has no place, it will not be tolerated, there was zero tolerance, your words mean nothing. You keep saying the same thing every time they trash the campus, every time they intimidate and threaten students. It's always the same empty rhetoric. You have no backbone. You do not show the courage of your convictions. And speaking of convictions, convictions are what they need to start chalking up to these people who keep breaking the law. Convictions in court. If there are students doing this, they should be expelled. They're brazen violations of the student code of conduct. This is not expression. This is criminal activity. If there are staff people, they should be fired. Quit playing games with these creeps. That is what they are. quit trying, you know, quit. The default position of the UW seems to be they're not all that way. They're not all creeps. There are some people who feel so strongly about this, and we need to hear them. We have heard them, and America rejects them. They reject them because they know that they are supporting Hamas, which is basically the Gaza equivalent of Al-Qaeda, a virulently barbaric, intolerant organization of anti-Semites. Their goal is to wipe the Middle East clean of any Jewish homeland and any Jews, for that matter. They don't want Jews living in the Middle East either, where, of course, they are indigenous. Remember when that word used to mean, supposedly still means a lot? I guess not. To the left, I guess not. And so, you know, there is nothing wrong in the Middle East that Hamas is going to cure. And it's time to quit hiding behind these euphemisms of pro-Palestine. They're not pro-Palestine. They're virulently anti-Israel. They're anti-Jewish. And they are pro-terrorism. Start calling them what they freaking are. It is 20 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning. Philip J. Vandenberg III right around the corner with a social media sweep. Good morning. Well, that gorgeous moon is going away for a little while. It's 25 minutes after 7 o'clock. It is Friday, the middle of November, 15th day. Philip J. around the corner with a social media sweep. What do you got?
We'll get to, apparently, I didn't realize this, but our state is facing a $10 to $12 billion budget shortfall. Had you heard about this?
The answer is, yeah, I knew it was coming.
Wow. Uh-huh. Okay. I can't help but think that this may have had a bearing on the election for governor if we would have had a little bit more attention on this in the last month or two.
Well, it also is that 10 to 12 billion short of what they want to spend in the next biennium or from what they're currently spending?
I'll go through the specifics here. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. This whole story comes by way of the longtime Olympia legislative and governor beat writer Jerry Kornfield, who writes for the Washington State Standard. Mm-hmm. And the headline on the story says, with a $10 billion deficit looming, Washington's governor calls on state agencies to make cuts. Story goes on to say Washington's outgoing governor, Inslee, says reductions are needed to balance the next state budget. Lawmakers may also consider new taxes when they convene next year. A November 8th memo from Inslee's budget director cited rising costs, increasing demand for public services, and lower than expected tax collections for projected operating budget shortfall from $10 billion to $12 billion over the next 4 years. So to recap.
Over the next 4 years.
Yeah, four years. So to recap, rising costs. This is everything that we've been battling about with the four initiatives that were up for vote here in this state. Increasing demand for public services. That, to me, sounds like the housing first policy that King County and Governor Inslee have on everything related to homelessness, which gets so incredibly expensive, and then lower than expected tax collections. So a great combination of
why do we have lower than expected? You know what tax they've had the biggest drop in?
I don't know. Maybe capital gains. Yeah.
Capital gains because
they lost out on a lot when Jeff Bezos decided to not operate in the state anymore.
Yes. People are leaving.
And so it says that some of this information was out before the election, but Governor Inslee puts out this memo to the other state agencies on November 8th, two and a half, three days after the election. Great timing. Great timing, boss.
Well, no, the timing,
of
course, is deliberate.
If any of this stuff would have come up in October.
He didn't want it to be an issue in the
election.
Would
it have had a bearing exactly on the election? How people could have perceived this vote between Bob Ferguson and Dave Reichert? How they could have perceived this vote based on the initiatives?
Jay Inslee has only done one thing, and that is grow the government. He hasn't made government more efficient, and he hasn't made it more affordable. He's just made it bigger.
And made it to unsustainable levels.
Please, the man won the Super Bowl of COVID. Let's not shortchange his accomplishments.
Right. Good reminder there, young Zach. Good reminder.
Sorry, the big game of COVID. I don't want to get copyrighted.
Okay, yeah, that's true. And then another social media post, this one from the LA Times, and it comes by way of polling done at the University of California, Berkeley, and their Institute of Government Studies. Guess who would be the top contender for California governor in 2026? Kamala Harris.
Yeah, I was going to say it would probably be Kamala Harris.
That poll found that if Harris enters the 2026 gubernatorial race for California, nearly half of voters would be very or somewhat likely to support her. So You can own it, California. There
that
you go.
Turned a lot of people off.
Tailor made for the Gold Coast, the Golden State and the Gold Coast of California. Okay. I was looking at the election results from the Secretary of State's page, you know, for the entire state of Washington.
Yes.
Because I was seeing, when I kept going back to check the election results, I was noticing, wow, there are definitely fewer people that were voting for the initiatives than they were, say, for president. So if we kind of approach this from a standpoint that most people that go out and vote, chances are they're voting for president because they understand that campaign, they understand those candidates, they understand that election. So we had over 3.8 million people in the state, according to the Secretary of State's page, that voted for president. And then we had slightly decreasing numbers, about 53,000 fewer people voted in the race for governor. So that tells me that 53,000 people either didn't care or didn't know who to vote for governor in, you know, relation to they did know who to vote for president. And about 100,000 fewer voters voted on the U.S. Senate race between Maria Cantwell and Raul Garcia. And then I started looking at the initiatives, and the initiative got the fewest amount of votes in this state was 2124. That was the long-term care tax and making it an opt-in, right? Yeah,
making it optional.
And we talked about how the initiatives in the voter's guide and on the ballot, the wording was maybe not easy to understand or became confusing. And so you had 170,000 fewer people that voted for the long-term care tax vote than president. And so that had the least amount of votes in the state. I take that to make that mean it's the most confusing of all of the four initiatives. The least confusing was the one that got the most votes amongst the initiatives, and that was on the capital gains tax. And the second most confusing would have been the I-2066, the access to natural gas. And that was the one that passed. So it shows that there was definitely a lot of people that just decided, I don't know what's going on with these initiatives, I'm not voting on them, compared to how many more voted for president.
And by the way, just in terms of overall vote, there's about a little over 5 million registered voters in Washington, and just barely under 4 million voted, about 78% turnout. You're listening to the John Carlson Show, 31 minutes after 7. When we come back, Steve Moore. You see him all the time on Fox News. For some reason, he hasn't been given a cabinet post yet. We'll talk to him about that coming right up. Oh, it's not too late to talk to Steve Moore. In fact, it's right on time. You see him all the time on Fox News. And, of course, his great new book, The Trump Economic Miracle. He is, of course, chief economist of the John Carlson Show. Steve Moore, it's great to hear your voice this morning. Are you in Washington?
I just got back. I was in West Palm Beach all week, and it's a big circus going on there to see who's going to get what positions. And the president asked me if I would be the Treasury Secretary, and I said, no, I could not give up my job for the John Carlson Show. Sorry, Mr. President.
Yeah, come on, Mr. President. Priorities. Priorities.
But anyway, it's an exciting time. I think the thing I'm most excited about.
What's it like back there, Steve? I mean, you've been around political situations all your life. What is it like at Mar-a-Lago right now?
Well, it's just people are not just Mar-a-Lago, around the country, because I've been traveling a bit the last week and a half since the election. People are just my joke is that, you know, Kamala Harris promised she would bring America joy, and boy, has she brought joy to the country. I mean, people are just, you see a little hop in the step of people that I think people are feeling optimistic about the future or about our country. And so it's a real sense of optimism and a real sense of, the good things that are to come. It's just everybody's in a happy mood. And, you know, even some of my Democrat friends are like, well, you know what? I don't really like Trump too much, but, you know, he was good for the economy, he was good for jobs, and he kept inflation down. And so that's the mood.
What's it like in Washington, D.C., right?
It's like a morgue. It's like, because I think the most excited thing I'm feeling right now in terms of what Trump is talking about doing is this Elon Musk commission. I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars we're going to save. We're going to drain the swamp. We are going to, you know, move the power out of Washington, where, you know, I cited the statistic to you a few weeks ago, but I want to repeat it. Only 8% of federal workers are working full-time on the job in their offices. It's unbelievable. You go into these big cavernous buildings. You've been to D.C. many times, John, and, you know, you see the Department of Labor and Department of Agriculture and Department of Interior, these gigantic buildings. You walk through them, nobody's there. Hey, I got an idea for raising money. Why don't we sell them? You know?
By the way, I should give context to our listeners. 92% of Washington, D.C. voters, okay, voters who live in Washington, D.C., 92% voted for Kamala Harris.
What do you get? I thought it was 93%, but I mean, yeah, it's like it's hard to find a Republican around. And you know, these people are terrified that, oh my gosh, they're gonna take my job away. But this whole idea of downsizing things, and I love what Elon Musk said when you know they said, "Do you really think you can cut the federal budget and find the waste?" And he said, "Look, when I took over Twitter, I cut the expense by 80%. You know, so and I still turned a profit." So he's
when you,
an expert at, I can't think of anybody better than Elon to do this.
When you and I were political tadpoles, okay, we're going all the way back to the mid-'80s.
Mid-'80s, yeah.
Yeah. President Ronald Reagan appointed the chairman of W.R. Grace, Peter Grace, to chair a commission, bring together business people from around America who would meet, gather, and give the federal government thousands of recommendations, some small, some large, some reforms, some, you know, program eliminations, consolidations, et cetera, et cetera, to the president. It was called the Grace Commission. Yep. And they came up with hundreds of billions of dollars in savings.
Yep.
There has not been since that time that I recall any effort to find waste in the federal budget. This at a time when the federal debt is now not $1 trillion, which it was
35.
When the Grace Commission,
but
now $35 trillion. And we're adding about $1.5 trillion every year.
Yeah. I mean, you summarized the situation perfectly, and you're exactly right about that. And you know, the Grace Commission was privately funded, I believe.
It was.
CEOs around the country who dedicated their time. And by the way, this is a huge process, folks. We're talking about we're going to need thousands of people involved in this. You know, there are at least 5,000 federal agencies. I mean, they're all over the place. We got programs that were started during World War One. We don't even know what they do anymore. Still get money. So, you know, it's going to take a huge, huge effort by everybody. And I think I want to see CEOs from around the country say, hey, look, I got some auditors who can come in and help figure out where the waste is. Why do we need 59 different special ed programs? Why do you need 72 different, employment job training programs? Why do we have all these still in the year 2024? Why do we still have all these massive agriculture subsidies? It's just because that's the way we've always done it. And that's all. And so what was the old joke that remember that Ross Perot used to say about when he visited the Department of Agriculture, he walked into one of the offices and the guy behind the desk was bawling and crying. And Ross Perot said, well, why are you crying? He said, because my farmer died. You know, so we probably got more people at the Department of Agriculture than we have farmers.
OK, so
it's just showing how much waste there is.
So let us give carte blanche to Elon and Vivek Ramaswamy let them go to town. Now, I want to talk to you about taxes.
People ask me, what do I want to do? And I said, look, the one thing I would really like to do is I want to help them, find how do we organize this in a way that we can go through every nook and cranny of the government? And by the way, Democrats and Republicans, everybody should be involved.
Look, there's waste everywhere. So just tell liberals, I tell you what, if you don't want to, find waste in social programs or urban grants and what? Okay, fine. Go find it in the Pentagon because there's waste there too.
Oh, for sure. It's the biggest. The Pentagon's the biggest bureaucracy in the world, and you could. I think you could cut $10 billion out of the Defense Department easily, and not at all affect our readiness or our national security.
So let me ask now, moving from spending because Elon's got that portfolio. Let's talk about the Steve Moore portfolio. Let's move to tax policy.
Yeah.
Will there be a tax package? What do you think it will look like? And will it have your initials on it?
Well, Laffer and I and Kudlow helped put together the original tax plan. We're very proud of that. And, so my job, my mission in life for the next 12 months when I'm not helping Elon Musk is to try to make sure we make that tax cut permanent, because I want to make sure your listeners understand this, Sean. A lot of the provisions of our tax bill would expire at the end of next year or about the middle of next year. And that would affect everybody, not just rich people. Right. It would affect, you know, the average person listening to this show. If you, you know, if you have a family, you're going to pay $2,500 a year more in your federal taxes if we allow that to happen. So we want to make those tax cuts permanent. We want to keep our tax rates as low as possible so we can compete in the world. And that one of the best ways of doing that. And the big issue, John, and this is something for you to chew on, because yeah. I really respect your opinion. But if we were, people keep saying, oh, Trump's, you know, a terrorist, they're going to be a disaster, they're going to cause a recession and a stock market crash and so on. Boy, the stock market's done pretty well since he was elected. But if you just put in tariffs alone, yes, that would be negative for the economy. I agree. I'm a free trade guy. I understand that. Tariffs are taxes. But what people are leaving out is, yes, Trump will raise some tariffs, especially on China, but he also wants to reduce taxes on things made here in the United States. So in other words, if something's made in China, we're going to put a tax on it. If it's made in Michigan, we're going to cut the tax on it. I kind of like that idea.
It almost is like you have an incentive to build your products here in the States.
There you go. And even right. even in Washington State. By the way, Washington State and Nebraska were the only two states in the country that got bluer. John Carlson, I'm sorry.
Are you ready for
this? If this continues, I'm going to have to fire you.
That is actually, believe it or not, it's actually out of date. Washington was one of two states that voted more Democrat than they did in 2020 for president. It now now with late breaking votes, it has moved. And
really?
Donald Trump lost Washington by 19.5 percentage points in 2020. Donald Trump only lost Washington by 18.5 percentage points.
Oh, my God. All right, John, I retract what I said. Okay,
that's
I was
right.
about to give you a pink slip and say, John, your colleagues are not doing your job, but you have done it. And by the way, if that trend continues, by the way, by the year 2030, by the year 2200, we'll probably have
right.
a Republican.
That's right. Steve Moore, great hearing from you as always. Look forward to chatting again soon. It is Boeing time, 7:47 on the John Carlson Show. Talk Radio 570 KVI. Cheryl Atkinson, Emmy Award-winning journalist, right around the corner as the commute continues. Good morning. It's 8 minutes to 8 o'clock on the John Carlson Show. One of my favorite people, not just in the media, but favorite people, period, Cheryl Atkinson, Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist who now, of course, has her own national news magazine show. Very famous, very successful, Full Measure. You see it every Sunday morning on Como 4 at 10 a.m. It repeats at 11:30 at night. Good morning, Cheryl.
You say the nicest things.
That's because we want to make sure you want to keep joining us because we love
do.
Having you. So
thanks.
My favorite Trump appointee so far is Tom Homan, who's going to be the border czar. And when he was speaking about his portfolio, he went out of his way to mention, hey, we're going to start paying attention to some people who have been completely overlooked with the disgrace of opening the border, and that is all of these missing children. And sure enough, right on time, here comes a story you're doing on Full Measure about the number of kids crossing at the southern border illegally, but being admitted and then disappearing.
I mean, it's the people who seem to favor the open borders. It's just unfathomable how they don't seem to use common sense to think about what's really happening. We'll be speaking with a federal whistleblower who was called upon to process some of the kids. They had so many, they got people from other federal departments to volunteer to do this work on assignment. And she says that, you know, they immediately noticed signs of child trafficking. They would send these children to sponsors who in many instances were illegal immigrants themselves. And in one case, for example, she said over 300 kids were sent to one supposed sponsor's home or building in Texas, 300 kids. And she said, you know, when she tried to say we need to really better vet these sponsors for the children's safety, she met with dead end. Like, that's none of our business. Just
what?
Process them and get them moving.
We're talking about children. And there's signs, there's evidence that they might be being trafficked for abuse, sexual exploitation. And the response from the bureaucracy is not my department. Don't worry about it.
Exactly. And she's testified to Congress. Her name's Deborah White. I think people are going to find her story compelling and very credible. Actually, there were a couple whistleblowers that testified to the same thing. So this has to be taken care of. Something's got to be done about that.
Well, we got the right person now in charge, or who's going to be in charge, who's actually paying attention to this. It is disgraceful that it hasn't been a national priority. How many children are we talking about, Cheryl?
Well, there's hundreds of thousands, but 32,000 that we know they can't even track. So not all of them disappear. Some of them, they know where they went. But a government report recently said in the past 5 years, 32,000
wow.
that they cannot find that have disappeared into the system.
32,000. You don't want to miss Full Measure this Sunday, 10 a.m. Como 4, repeats at 11:30 at night. Cheryl Atkison, you always ask the right questions. Thank you. And getting the right answers. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
It is coming up on 7:56, 4 minutes to 8 o'clock, hour number 3 of the commute. Dead ahead on the John Carlson Show.
Thank God it's Friday.
Hour number 3 of the commute with Carlson this Friday, 15th day of November. Welcome, everybody. You are right where you need to be. We'll be going to have a busy last hour of the show. Want to start with something that I wanted to get to yesterday that I found so intriguing because it reveals so much of what was wrong about Kamala Harris and her campaign, which is they were so fake. They were so disingenuous. As you know, Joe Rogan has the most popular podcast in America. A podcast, how would you describe podcast, young Zach?
Radio that's successful. No, I'm kidding. Just podcasts. It's just talk radio. And that's why talk radio works so well, because yeah.
It's talk radio without a transmitter.
It's talk radio without a radio signal.
Yep.
It's on
internet talk radio.
Yeah. So it's basically talk radio on social media.
Sure.
And so we have a podcast here on this show. You have my radio show, and then we have a podcast on KVI.com. So Joe Rogan has the most popular podcast in the country. I believe he has 18.5 million.
That seems light. I'll pull
subscribers.
Up the number.
Okay, 18.5 million subscribers, people who pay to have access to his show.
That number's just his YouTube channel, pretty close.
Oh, just his YouTube. Yeah. Okay.
Spotify. On Spotify, he's got 14.5 million.
Okay, so we're talking, he's well over 30.
Yeah, I mean, some of these are going to be overlap, but it's substantial.
Okay.
And really, he's the biggest name in podcasting right now, and probably has the biggest audience in podcasting.
When he had Donald Trump on his show, for all 3 hours, by the way, Donald Trump sat with him for 3 hours, 54 million people viewed the podcast. By the way, how can you view a podcast if you don't subscribe?
Well, I mean, it's just a YouTube video.
Okay.
People put it up different ways.
So there's always ways to find it.
Yeah, and that's why some of these numbers, you know, you hear someone's got 14.5 million on Spotify, 17 million on YouTube or whatever. Sometimes there'll be some overlap. You might subscribe in different places, but.
But there's no, let's put it this way, 60 Minutes, I think it was like 18 million, something like that.
Well, in its heyday?
Yeah.
Yeah. a generation ago?
And most cable stations, the most successful, get 4 million, okay?
Yeah, like a Dancing with the Stars might get 4 million viewers.
Joe Rogan got, again, over 50 million views, meaning people tuned in for at least part of the Donald Trump interview. So it is especially popular with young men, and since Kamala Harris wanted to make sure she had the young vote on her side, and there was evidence that she was losing young men to Donald Trump, the decision was, hey, you got to get on Joe Rogan, do what Trump did. But there were two sets of concern, and it ended up dooming the entire idea. She never did appear on the Joe Rogan show. What happened? Well, for one thing, there were concerns about how the interview would be perceived within the Democratic Party. Now, this comes from Jennifer Palmieri, who's been a Democrat consultant, advisor, insider forever. She was a senior advisor to Kamala's husband, Doug Emhoff. Quote, there was a backlash with some of our progressive staff that didn't want her to be on it, and how there would be a backlash. So there were some people on the left who, oh, you don't even want to go on the show. Don't even dignify. In fact, if you don't dignify it, it'll be like it doesn't even exist. Okay. It will mean it has no impact. Again, keep in mind that Trump's interview with Rogan has been viewed 50 million times. Less than 30 million people watched Kamala Harris's speech at the Democratic National Convention on all stations combined.
So the same week that Joe Rogan podcast with Trump launched, that same week, the number one rated television program was Sunday Night Football, Dallas at San Francisco that week, with 21 million viewers.
There you go.
That's of all television, that was the number one thing. Didn't even cut half of the Trump podcast.
So Joe Rogan, 50 million. Top rated TV show, and it's almost always a football game during fall and winter, 21 million. There you have it. And the second reason that it didn't work is that Kamala's people wanted to stage manage the Joe Rogan show. First of all, instead of going to Rogan, who's in Texas, where Kamala Harris made an appearance, she made an appearance in Houston. She wanted him to fly to Washington, D.C. You come to me. Secondly, instead of, you know, this 3-hour show you do, we'll just sit down together for 1 hour. And then, according to Rogan, I'll quote him here so no one will accuse me of being out of context. They had, I don't know how many conversations with my folks, but multiple conversations giving different dates, different times, different this, different that. We knew she's going to be in Texas, so I said, hey, open invitation. And then I think they had requirements on things that she didn't want to talk about. She didn't want to talk about marijuana legalization, which I thought was hilarious. And the reason she didn't want to talk about marijuana is because there was a time when she was prosecutor where she was busting people for marijuana. Quote from Joe Rogan, she put a lot of people in jail for weed, close quote, which is true. She got nailed with that by, of all people, Tulsi Gabbard, when Tulsi Gabbard was a Democrat and she was running for president, the presidential nomination as a Democrat. So she would sit down with Rogan for 1 hour instead of three in a location that she preferred him to be at in Washington, D.C., and please don't bring up the following subjects, including marijuana. And they said, no, Joe Rogan doesn't need her to be successful. And by the way, I should point out, Joe Rogan is not a political talk show. Zach, how would you describe the Joe Rogan show? He talks about just a myriad number.
Yeah, I'm not an avid listener or subscriber, but because of just the reach of his program, basically, I mean, a lot of it permeates through stuff I'll see, but he's really just anything and everything is what he talks about. He talks to interesting people, Elon Musk, he talks to a lot of comedians, of course, him himself a comedian, and he's just very good at asking questions and letting people talk is kind of his podcast, if I had to sum it up in a nutshell.
Yeah. And he doesn't always talk to one person for three full hours. Sometimes he does.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just goes as long as the conversation. Is it always one guest?
Yes.
Always one
guest?
Yeah,
he doesn't have a panel or anything usually.
And how many days a week?
I'm not sure. Okay. I think one episode a week, but I'll check.
Okay. Anyway, he's fabulously wealthy, fabulously successful. And again, Donald Trump really helped himself by going on the Joe Rogan show. Would Kamala have helped herself going on the Joe Rogan show? Probably no. Ultimately, I don't think she could have done herself much good because, again, she is so guarded. And she's so guarded because, I've told you my theory on this, she's much further to the left than she lets on. She's probably every bit as far left as Pramila Jayapal, the Seattle congresswoman. But she knows she has to win an election in a center-right nation. And the people who are moderate to moderately conservative, they have no interest in a progressive left-wing agenda. So she has to try and read a script that makes her as mainstream as possible. And that's why she didn't like off-the-cuff questions. She didn't like press conferences. She didn't like open-form interviews because she's not comfortable when she's off script because she's on a script to conceal where she really is coming from. Anyway, I guess that's all in the past, as Steely Dan would say.
One more thing. So I looked up, Joe Rogan releases 3 to 4 podcasts a week, but there was one other podcast that I think made a very big difference in the election. That was Theo Vaughn's podcast. That's another podcast that's very, very, very big. Not political, it's another comedian. J.D. Vance went on that podcast, and for anybody who watched it, that was a really good showing of J.D. Vance, and they invited Tim Walz on, and I don't have any documentation as to why that didn't happen, but I do know he was invited, and that never happened either. So there were two non-political podcasts that, you know, certainly reached middle America and young voters and young men, and that was another one that was a big misstep for the Harris campaign as well, not doing that in any capacity. And Theo Vaughn did a podcast with Trump. It was just months prior. He did go to Trump for that. But J.D. Vance went on this Theo Vaughn podcast and on an apolitical show. They didn't even really talk politics. It was just kind of two normal dudes talking. And I think that had a big impact as well, especially with young voters.
Very good. Very good. Anyway, one more reason why Kamala Harris was just, you know, stuck in the past, and why she was losing opportunities to connect with American voters. By the way, the young vote went to Joe Biden by over 30 points. The young vote went to Kamala Harris by, I think, 5 points. She lost young men outright to Donald Trump by a sizable majority. And young single women basically gave her an advantage with just that demographic of young voters. But Biden had won that group, young voters, 18 to 29, by over 30 points. She wins it by 5. Talk about momentum going in Donald Trump's direction. All right, by the way, something else that happened on Election Day that a lot of people are probably unaware of, and I think it's a very good sign. Drug legalization took a hit. There have been a number of states that have voted for marijuana legalization, which I would argue, you know, the 14 states in the past 4 years, legalizing marijuana has not made Washington a better place. In fact, I think part of the reason for the intensification of homelessness and drugs is because of legalizing recreational marijuana and then not enforcing prohibitions on smoking it outdoors. You're only supposed to have weed in your home. And the former city attorney in Seattle said, oh, I'm not enforcing that. People want to smoke outside, it's their business. I mean, it's not like they're smoking a cigarette or a cigar or something really damaging to them. Anyway, you've seen the studies, or maybe you've heard about the studies, that there's a 35% increase in chronic homelessness in places that legalize weed, a 70% increase in psychosis among teenagers, 1,400 traffic deaths a year are being laid on people driving under the influence of marijuana, and also something that used to be mocked is that marijuana could be addictive. It is addictive, and it can lead to psychosis because it is so much more potent than it used to be, far, far more potent than it was in the 70s and 80s. And so the word's starting to get around. In Florida, voters failed to approve a constitutional amendment to legalize recreational marijuana. It was expected to pass, and boy, did they have a lot of money to do it. But the voters said no. In Massachusetts, they had a ballot measure to legalize psychedelic drug. That went down by 14 percentage points. Get this. In Florida, do you know how much money was spent by the cannabis industry to legalize marijuana, recreational marijuana in Florida? $150 million.
Okay. I remember Costco floated something like $20 or $25 million to get the privatization
of liquor
initiative passed here in the state of Washington.
$150 million to legalize marijuana, and it failed. Nebraska did approve medical marijuana, but several other states said no. North Dakota said no. South Dakota said no. This is the first time we're now seeing states say, you know what, not such a great idea. So we might have reached the point where people are having second thoughts about the wisdom of legalizing weed. And I wish people had reached that period of wisdom about 15 years ago, because we wouldn't have some of the problems, at least to the extent we have them today, if the voters of Washington had said no. It is now 21 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning. The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J. Vandervoort III around the corner, his favorite segment of the day, his last one of the week. Social media from socialists on The Commute with Carlson. All right. 26 minutes now after 8 o'clock in the morning. The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J. Vandervoort III standing by. The social media sweep, social media from socialists. Go for it.
I'm going to give you some audio from the Seattle Congresswoman, Pramila Jayapal, here in just a moment. Social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. And this came by way of an MSNBC post-election interview. And
yeah,
Jayapal basically saying that Democrats, if they're going to win these elections, you know, in light of what Trump was able to do with this election, they've got to increase the minimum wage and they've got to increase union density. Here's what she said on MSNBC.
We can be against something, but what are we for? Yeah. Why have we not the minimum wage? Why have we not helped increase union density? Why were Democrats for NAFTA and trade agreements? You know, this goes back. It's not just
there. She is kind of talking about the minimum wage and increasing union density. And this kind of comes back to this whole concept of Democrats want to be the party that picks winners and losers. And we've seen that mm-hmm. in the state of Washington with the Climate Commitment Act that Inslee imposed and various increases in minimum wages by county or city here in this state as well. But that's what Democrats think is a success going forward. Meanwhile, over at Politico did a profile on the southwestern Washington U.S. Congresswoman Marie Glusenkamp Perez. And they write, Politico writes, at the forefront of a handful of Democratic lawmakers convinced they can provide a blueprint for Democrats eager to write what went wrong in the 2024 election. And one of the things that they write, Glusenkamp Perez ran ahead of Kamala Harris in every county in her Southwest Washington congressional district by 4 to 7 points. So she was generating more votes than Kamala Harris in this last election. So is she going to become a face of Democrats going forward as they try and, you know, pick up the pieces after Kamala Harris fumbled this chance to maintain control of the White House for Democrats?
6-word answer.
Yeah.
Only if they want to win.
Oh, okay.
If the Democrats want to start winning again, start running normal people for public office.
Mm-hmm.
Start running people who are actually listening to people instead of ideologues.
Yep. The activist wing, as I like to complain, has taken over the Democratic Party. We've seen that with the Hamasniks that Ari Hoffman has pointed out. That's manifested itself on the college campuses after Hamas attacked Israel. We've got the activists with the $15, now $20 or $21 minimum wage or $24 minimum wage. Depending on what jurisdictions you're talking about.
Let's show we really care. Let's say $38 an hour minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know, these people coming up with ideas on how to help working class people not only have never run a business, most have never worked for a private business.
Yeah, that goes back to the Kamala Harris situation.
It's just, you know, they've been working for nonprofits and government agencies and political offices, and that's their life.
Yeah.
All things government.
I've got one more quick one to send us all off into the weekend with. It's not socialist on social media, but it does revolve around Trump nominating Robert F. Kennedy Jr. for Health and Human Services Secretary. And, you know, one of RFK Jr.'s big deals is what's up with food additives and the ingredients in foods. He's deeply concerned about this. And one person I follow on social media responded by saying, Junior, you'll take my crunch berries from my cold, dead hands, you brainworm-addled quack.
Serenity now!
We want our Captain Crunch berries.
Just be careful when you tread close to that fast food line, Mr. Kennedy.
That's been
there's a
factor.
Reason there's fast foods all over the place. Well, it's popular.
Do you remember the documentary guy that did Super Size It? He just passed away a couple years ago.
Yes.
And his whole premise of his documentary Super Size It was, wow, fast food is really bad for you. I'm going to eat it every day for 2 months or whatever it was to show you how bad it is. Well, duh, you're not supposed to eat it every day.
I'm going to eat it every meal of every day.
Right? Exactly.
And then gorge himself.
It was such a flawed premise, and he got praised by everybody on the Democrat. Oh, his documentary is so good. Like, no.
That
premise is dumb and it's flawed. You're not supposed to do that every day.
I considered that a blueprint for my life.
Have a salad every once in a while, man.
So what I'm hearing, you guys, is that tonight, the most popular sporting event of the weekend is tonight, and it's not a football game. If you want to know what it is, I'm going to tell you right around the corner here on The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. It's 37 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Well, the biggest, most popular, most likely, the most watched sporting event is going to happen this weekend at Dallas Cowboys Football Stadium, AT&T Stadium, but it's not a Dallas Cowboys football game. In fact, it's not a football game, period. It's a fight. It's a boxing match between Mike Tyson. Remember Iron Mike Tyson?
I broke my back.
What do you mean by that?
My back is broken.
What, a vertebrae or what portion?
Spinal.
Okay. I'm not sure exactly what Mike was referring to, because most people, when they break their spine, they're in a wheelchair. But every once in a while, he's been known to exaggerate. Anyway, Mike Tyson is squaring off against YouTube sensation Jake Paul. It's going to happen tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern time. It should be 5 p.m. our time. It is streaming on Netflix. Again, that's streaming on Netflix. There's going to be 7 fights on the card, including three for championship belts. But the big heavyweight fight is between Mike Tyson and Jake Paul. What to make of all this? Well, the guy we go to whenever we talk about fisticuffs around here is our program director and aspiring Ultimate Fighter, Kevin Doddrell, the Dodderer. Welcome to the John Carlson Show, Kevin.
Oh, thank you so much. Every boxing fan wants to talk about a YouTube sensation fighting a 58-year-old ex-boxer. This is exactly what we love to do. So thank you so much for having me, John.
But let me ask you, it looks like people do want to see this happen. Explain why there's so much drama, so much excitement, so much anticipation about this square off between Tyson and Jake Paul.
Well, it's called prize fighting for a reason. And when you get a lot of people interested, the prize is really big. And Jake Paul has people interested because, you know, since he was a kid, he's been doing his social media stuff. And, of course, Mike Tyson is a guy who people have been interested in ever since he started, you know, doing his thing as a heavyweight back in the 80s.
He was, I believe, heavyweight champion at the age of 20.
Yeah, he's the youngest heavyweight champion ever.
And
he's also one of the shortest, which people forget about.
Yeah, he was heavyweight champion for a few years and then ended up in prison on a sexual assault conviction, and his career kind of went up and down ever since then. Tell us about Jake Paul. A lot of KVI listeners might not even know who this guy is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like I said, you know, these YouTube celebrities and social media guys, I'm like, you know.
But is he a boxer? Is he a boxer or an ultimate fighter, Kevin?
He's a boxer, and he's taken it pretty seriously the last few years. He takes on a lot of other YouTube stars and then guys that do MMA, but usually guys that are smaller than him, guys that aren't true boxers. The first time he decided to fight a true boxer, he lost. That is the one loss on his record. So, yeah, he has, like I said, he chooses people who aren't real boxers. And then this is probably his biggest opponent yet, who's a real boxer. But yet again, Mike is 58 years old. So,
okay. So they did their weigh-in. Was it yesterday?
It was, yeah.
And, you know, there's always a lot of trash talking between the fighters and, you know, a little bit of build up to try and make sure people are going to be tuning in. But Tyson actually smacked the guy.
Yeah, he slapped him, apparently.
Which
is a thing that happens quite often during weigh-ins, because oftentimes it seems like that happens when it looks like not a lot of people are going to buy the fight. Of course, this is on Netflix, so if you have a Netflix subscription, you don't have to pay for it. But usually they do that sort of thing to drum up more attention.
Now, this is not going to be a typical boxing match either, is it? I mean, they're both going to have boxing gloves, but they're going to have, for instance, 2-minute rounds instead of 3-minute rounds, right?
Correct. And the gloves are bigger. I believe they're 14 ounce instead of typically a heavyweight bout in professional boxing, they're 10 ounce gloves. So these gloves are kind of gloves you'd use to spar in, a little thicker padding and that sort of thing. This is, again, this is kind of the thing that Jake Paul does that people don't really talk about, because most people don't like to get into the weeds. They don't really care about the size of the ring or, you know, what the glove size is or how long the rounds are. But this is the sort of thing that that you negotiate when you're trying to stack the deck for you.
Okay. Is there anything else different about this boxing match?
It's 8 rounds instead of 10 or 12, is my understanding as well. Typically, sometimes these sorts of influencer bouts are not usually sanctioned by an athletic commission. This is, so it will go on their pro records. Texas Commission is well known for bending the rules and allowing things like a 58-year-old man to fight a 28. There's a reason why it's in Texas.
So Mike Tyson, who, by the way, looks like he did in the old days in terms of his physique, even though he's 58 years old, Jake Paul, is he bigger than Mike Tyson?
He's taller. Like I said, Mike's really short. My understanding, I think Mike weighed more than Jake. Jake typically fights at light heavyweight, which is the cutoff for that is 175 pounds. This is at heavyweight. A lot of people have been saying that Jake looks like he's been taking his quote unquote vitamins, and Mike looks like he's been taking his vitamins as well. And again, it's happening in Texas, where I believe there's probably no drug testing.
Drug test? What drug test?
I'm not implying anything here, but all right. Yes.
Okay. So you got a prediction?
Yeah, I think, the undefeated person or thing in boxing is always Father Time. And usually when guys like Mike or Muhammad Ali get up in age and they do something like this, Father Time isn't kind. So I think that Jake will win. I'm not going to predict how. I think Mike, if this is legit, again, who knows what the contract says, but Mike, I think, is going to probably gas out within 2 to 3 rounds, and it will either go the distance and Jake will win by a decision, or it will be stopped either by the referee just having sympathy for Mike. But that's usually what happens when a young guy fights an old guy. But, you know, if it's legit and Mike clips him in the first 2 rounds, 3 rounds, then maybe it could get interesting. But I think Jake is talented enough and smart enough to know to keep away from him early and then just kind of get things done later.
Wait till he's winded.
After round 4.
Yeah, but again, we're talking about a grand total of 16 minutes of actual fighting. 2-minute rounds, 8-round match, right?
Yes, correct.
So you think we're going to see something happen by the 4th round?
Yeah, I think that if it makes it to round 4, then it's not going to look great for Mike. He's going to look really old.
Okay, again, Jake Paul's 27. He's 9-1. Mike Tyson is 58 and has not boxed professionally since 2005, Kevin.
Yeah. And I believe his last 3 fights are losses, if I'm not correct. His last fight, I think, was against Danny McBride. You know Danny McBride, right?
The TV guy?
No. Yeah, I mean, there's a Danny McBride who's a TV guy. But, yeah, no, Mike's last few fights were very, very, like, again, he was getting up there in age, not nowhere near 58, and he looked really bad back his last 2-3 pro fights.
Okay.
Not great, so.
All right. You know, I'm intrigued, and I have a Netflix subscription, so I just might make the time to watch this. Kevin Dodrell, our program director and our expert on all things fisticuffs here on The Commute with Carlson. Thanks, Kevin. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, John. You
too. Got it. It is 8:48, 12 minutes to 9 o'clock on The John Carlson Show. Back we are. Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. There's a very popular DJ in America, a syndicated radio host named Charlemagne the God. He is particularly popular in the black community. And he was talking the other day about Donald Trump meeting with Joe Biden, and he couldn't quite wrap his mind around, wait a minute, this is the guy you were just calling a fascist, and now you're smiling and meeting with him? What's that about?
I just don't understand the White House visit. Now, granted, you know, I'm glad it's a peaceful transition of power, but what happened to the threat of democracy talk? What happened to the fascist talk? By the way, I know I've said those things about Trump as well, but I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about his political opponents like President Biden. When they say it, it holds way more weight than me. I'm just trying to figure out, how do you go from he's an existential threat to democracy? So welcome back. I was happy too.
Yeah, of course. But what he's pointing out is they said it. They said it over and over again, and they knew it wasn't true. So once the race is over and Donald Trump wins convincingly, he not only wins the Electoral College, he wins every swing state in the Electoral College. He not only wins the Electoral College, he wins the popular vote. He not only wins the popular vote, but he brings with him a Republican U.S. Senate, 53 senators and very nearly a 54th. He not only wins the Senate, but he brings with him a larger Republican House. And all of a sudden, Donald Trump's not an existential threat to democracy anymore. All of a sudden, Donald Trump is not a fascist anymore. All of a sudden, he's not a Hitler lover anymore. He's, hey, come on over to the White House. Let's sit down and talk. Have a peaceful transition. It just goes to drive home. There was nothing genuine, nothing honest about their message. They were just throwing everything they could at the wall against Donald Trump and hoping that some of it stuck, and hardly any of it did. And that's why he is our new incoming president. Hey, get out there. Enjoy this weekend. Let's talk again on Monday. Go Huskies. Go Seahawks. Talk to you soon.
I broke my back.
What do you mean by that?
My back is broken.
What, a vertebrae or what portion?
Spinal.